the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney.
Well, as many of you know, we recently were giving presentations in the Bahamas and in South Florida. And the suggestion by many of our listeners has been to provide some of the slides from those presentations online for their review. What we decided to do today is to actually give that presentation and for you to know what you missed when we were in the Bahamas discussing the gold market in particular, and sort of our three-year gold outlook, what we expect to see happen in the gold and silver market over the next several years. So we're going to go over the supply and demand fundamentals, and I'm just going to go kind of orderly through the slides that were presented there in the Bahamas, and we've provided those slides to you. If you want to follow through those slides as we go this morning, feel free. And just as an overview, you know, so that you know who the McIlvaney Financial Group is and to give some background, what we offer, we've been in the precious metals business for 40 years. That includes onshore product that's delivered, stored, using IRA funds. Offshore, we have two different programs. One that we have is a U.S.-based program, Delaware Depository, as well as a Swiss-based program, Global Gold. I was a founding program partner with Global Gold. Delaware Depository offers storage in Zurich, and here in the next few months, we'll also offer that in Toronto and Hong Kong. In addition to our precious metal solutions, we have our onshore money management. That's McIlvaney Wealth Management, with a focus on asset preservation, with a focus on conservative growth, and global thematics being, global macro thematics being a big part of what we look at in the process of choosing appropriate allocations in your more traditional asset classes. And then, of course, we have our informational resources, which you're well familiar with. The weekly audio commentary, monthly big picture newsletter. Don's been publishing the McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor for nearly 40 years. And then once a year, we put together a film, When Greed Turns to Fear, Conquering the Chaos, Beyond the Brink, all with very fun and exciting titles. We'll begin producing this year's DVD here shortly. It's basically our State of the Union, if you will, a look at what we think is happening in the world today at this moment, and some of the things practically that an investor can do. So, again, today we're going to look at our three-year gold outlook, where we're at and where we're going. Let me just say this. We've been in a bull market for the last 10 years, and this has been one of the more powerful bull markets in history in the metals market, although, as we see, as we'll look at here this morning, we have actually quite a bit farther to go relative to the 1970s, and given the macro dynamics that we have in place today. So what we wanted to start with is when we look at the gold market over the last 10 years, just to look at sort of the gradual change that we've seen in the price of gold. While we look back and say, okay, the difference between almost 1800 today and 250 is pretty extreme, what we note is that it's been very slow and steady. It's been anything but a radical move to the upside. I mean, just to illustrate that, you look at 2000, 2001, 2002. In fact, those moves from $273 an ounce up to 6 years later, $638 an ounce. It took 6 years for the price of gold to double the first time. And then between 2006 and 2010, another 4 years for the price to double again at roughly $1,400 an ounce. That's our anticipation that we see the price of gold double in a two-year period between 2010 and 2012. And essentially what you're seeing is an increase in the rate of change. And this is very significant because for anyone who's interested in knowing where we're at, where we're going, for anyone who's interested in seeing sort of the ultimate trajectory of the gold price, this is very important to note. The price of any asset that's in the bull market will tend to accelerate as time goes on. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. Again, 6 years for the price of gold to double the first time, 4 years for the price of gold to double yet again, 2 years for it to double yet again, if our estimation is correct, sometime between 2012, perhaps the early part of 2013. And what you'll note particularly is that when a bull market has reached sort of its full bloom, when it is done, it will see a rate of change of between 100 and 150% per year. So We're not at that point where the price of gold has doubled in a single year, or even more than doubled in a single year. And this is just one of many telltales that the market is getting too far advanced to be of interest for new purchases and probably has more downside than upside. That's what we would say. We still have a long way to go in terms of price change, but actually it's going to be happening on a quicker and quicker basis. So our encouragement is for anyone who's considering the precious metals market and is in that phase of hesitating to see if they get better prices, just understand that just like any bull market, as you get into an advanced stage, it does not wait around for anyone. And so if you are interested, then a decision needs to be taken quickly in advance of what we would view as sort of the third and final stage. So again, if you look at those price increases, it's been incremental. It's been slow. It's been steady. But gradually, it is speeding up. Now, if you look at the actual chart of gold, that is a very impressive picture of an incredibly powerful bull market. You can see sort of a steady two steps forward, one step back, beginning in 2000, 2001, with a very low price of under $300 an ounce and exceeding the 1920 level here recently. We have seen sort of this steady, moderated two steps forward, one step back. Something that we did a few weeks ago, this was actually about 6 or 8 weeks ago, we had sent out a special report, a news blast, if you will, just to say that gold had gone down and touched its 65-week moving average, a very significant point at about 1530, and it was our view that from that point forward, the gold price would be moving higher, that technically that represented sort of a rock-bottom support. Lo and behold, the day we sent that out, 1530 marked its low, and it's moved up $250 since then. So the critical thing about noting this gold market is, again, if there is an opportunity on a pullback to add, it needs to be done decisively, it needs to be done quickly, because it simply doesn't wait around. So again, you look at the picture and you say, well, that's in a very advanced bull market. You look at how far it's gone, how fast it's gone, but as we noted before, it's actually been quite gradual, two steps forward, one step back, over a decade or more. The fundamental things that are driving the gold price, if you consider supply and demand is what ultimately impacts any market, whether it is a decreasing supply or increasing demand. And in the case of gold, you actually have both. So we'll talk a little bit about both of these and look at supply first and then demand secondly as a critical component, fundamental component. When you look at supply in the gold market, one of the things that you have to note is that it's been in decline several percentage points per year for the last decade. And it's just here this year, 2012, where there is an expected increase in supply coming from new mining projects, which have taken 7 to 10 years to bring on stream. And it's expected that this new little up cycle in supply will have been accomplished, if you will, by 2014. So we're not talking about huge projects that have come online, but there is an increase of several hundred tons per year that are going to be coming to the market on the basis of new mine supply. The two major components, as you just mentioned, one is new mine supply, the other is recycled gold. And of course, anyone who's driven around the United States has seen phenomenon. Just about everybody and their brother is buying gold. Now, that's not to say the average man on the street or woman on the street is going out and buying gold as an investment. That is to say, there's lots of kiosks all over the place which are purchasing your gold, old jewelry, old silver flatware, et cetera, and recycling it, paying you a steep discount to the current spot price, and then turning around and melting it down, profiting considerably, and adding that supply into the marketplace. So those two components are very critical, new mine supply, as well as recycled product. Now, the recycled product has taken on a larger and larger role over the last several years, but does tend to come in waves. It comes in waves at significant price levels. So when we got to the old highs of 850, 875, we saw a mad rush of people going into their safety deposit boxes, into their jewelry boxes, looking for the out-of-date jewelry and taking it down the street and melting it down for what they considered to be top dollar at the time. Now, in retrospect, the price has gone even higher, but we've seen that same sort of liquidation cycle at critical price points. So 850, 875 was the first simply because it was the old high. Then we had 1,000, and that was more or less because it was a round number and people were impressed with it. They had never seen it before. Then at 1,500, another mad rush of people selling gold on that basis. And I'm sure we'll see another increase at around 2,000 an ounce. But one of the things that we're noticing is that there is a declining trend there. Well, it ramped up for 10 years. Now, all of a sudden, the safety deposit boxes are empty. Jewelry boxes have already been cleaned out, and the old, antiquated, or out-of-style jewelry, it's already been melted down or exchanged for something that is in vogue today. So that, while it has gone from being at the low side at the beginning of the decade, about 19% of supply, it now is around, this year will end up being 38 to 39% of total supply. And then over the next several years, declining. So those two things have to be looked at. In total, you're talking about roughly 4,000 tons of new gold that is brought to market every year. These two components are the contributors to that 4,000 tons that's available every year. Roughly 2,500 is from the mine supply, and 1,500 is from this recycling process. So that's what we wanted to say about supplies. You have to understand where it's coming from, but also anticipate that beyond 2013, 2014, there's a number of folks, including the World Gold Council, have even suggested that by 2014, we will have been considered to be peak gold. And I'm not sure how to process that precisely. I don't know if that's a concept I'm particularly open to, peak gold, but the reality is there's less and less rich ore bodies where you have very rich veins of gold which are easy to mine and are in politically stable environments. There's more and more small finds of gold in very unstable political environments in places that are very hard to extract. And so the cost of production is incredibly high. The ability to make this profitable, very difficult, and the political risk off the chart. So that is one of the things that's constraining new mine supply versus, say, the 1970s, where you could go to two places. You could go to Russia and you could go to South Africa, and you, in these two countries, had roughly 90% of the world's mineral reserves, and in the 1970s, roughly 70% of gold production coming from South Africa. So a huge boom to the wealth building of that country at that time. Now, they have seen peak production and have been steadily in decline since the 80s. So that's the problem, is there's no significant ore bodies on the supply side. Now, on the demand side, this is the other equation. You're looking at these fundamental variables. Demand forever and a day has been jewelry-related as well as industrial-related. And these two components, industrial certainly more for silver than for gold. Industrial demand for gold doesn't tend to exceed 10, 12, 15% in a big year, where most of your demand is, in fact, jewelry. We mentioned 4,000 tons is current total available gold between recycling and mine production. Roughly 2,000 of that goes, in demand terms, to jewelry. So it's the other 2,000, which is split up very unevenly, small percentage to industrial uses, and the remainder to investment demand. Investment demand is coins and bars. Investment demand over the last several years, the mixture has changed from being central bank dominant to individual dominant, where individual investors, institutions, family offices have looked at precious metals and said, we think we need a hedge. We think we need something to offset losses, volatility. Yeah, and here in just a minute, we'll look at sort of these three things that are inspirational, if you will, for the average investor. That it's non-correlated, that gold does very well during periods of low to negative real rates of return, and offers an interesting increase in purchasing power. And we'll look at each of these in a minute. Jewelry demand has continued to increase. Asia and the Indian subcontinent continue to buy gold. And frankly, it's not just as an investment, although that is coming on stream now very strongly. But this is a traditional asset that people have bought for social reasons, for cultural reasons, even for religious reasons. And if you start with India, this is something where, you know, a woman will wear her wealth, and as she goes into another family and marriage, actually has something of a dowry, but she keeps, this is her personal wealth. Men as well will wear jewelry, and often it's a sign of status. It's a symbol of significance in culture, a groundedness, if you will. Here's who I am. This is my presence, and we are of family that should be respected. So there's this cultural and social dimension which really takes price out of the equation and has kept demand fairly constant. When you see the numbers coming from China in terms of what is current demand, it's often reported that demand has been in decline because they're not taking as many tons off the market as they were last year, the year before that. And I think this is something that is not accurate, in fact, because what you see is a constant rupee value of gold being taken off of the market, where consumers are taking what they have every year in terms of saved currency and investing the same amount year after year after year after year in gold jewelry. But as the price of gold is increasing, quite obviously, there's less ounces involved. You're getting less gold for the money that you're investing. And on that basis, there is less demand for tons. But in terms of dollar values or rupee value, the demand is actually quite constant. The big increase in the Indian subcontinent and within Asia, China, Hong Kong, and throughout Asia, is for investment gold. These would be coins, these would be bars, not something that you would wear, but you might store in a home vault or in a bank vault or what have you. And, you know, a lot of this is in response to the inflationary trends that they see in that part of the world. I mean, to illustrate, they've had to limit the amount of gold coming into Vietnam. This is the government this last year and the year before as well, with inflation rates between 22 and 25%. I mean, think of that. Inflation between 22 and 25% per year, investors are not inclined to put deposits at the bank. They know that that currency is hemorrhaging, and they would much rather have their savings in precious metals. Now, that's created a bit of a problem because with the preference for precious metals over the domestic currency, that means there's a stiff competition. And the government has actually limited the amount of gold that is allowed to be imported. Of course, black market gold purchases still are thriving, and we'll continue to see that where the government tries to control a market. There has been and will continue to be a way around that there in Asia. But all that to say, demand is continuing to increase. Jewelry demand has been fairly constant. Again, that's roughly 2,000 tons per year. And investment demand, if you go back to something that Jeff Christian used to say, he works for the CPM Group, which was once Aaron Trading. Aaron Trading was a division of Goldman Sachs and then was ultimately spun off with a market, and he was speaking specifically of gold and silver. If you see an increase or a decrease in demand of even 1% or 2%, you're defining the trend either up or down. And so all that to say, markets are made at the edge. Markets are made at the margin. If you see a small increase in demand, then the price is moving up. And that's, in fact, what we've seen. The charts that we looked at and the price statistics we were just discussing earlier would indicate there's been a slow and steady increase in the audience for precious metals. Now, when you talk about non-correlation, this is one of the reasons why we in the West are interested in gold as well as in the East. The non-correlation we're going to start with by looking at the change in geography of demand, because one of the significant things that's happened between the 1980s and the present is that this demand geography has shifted considerably. And this is what I mean by that. Western Europe and the United States once dominated the gold market and consumed roughly 70% of all available gold. Now, that was at the peak in 1980. Today, we consume less than 30% between Europe and America, with now nearly 60% being consumed by Asia and the Indian subcontinent. And again, as we were mentioning earlier, the reasons aren't just investment. In fact, 2,000 tons a year jewelry purchases, this is again status, this is again family significance, this is again religious holidays, national holidays, reasons that people celebrate and buy on a consistent annual basis regardless of price. The change in geography is very significant because in the West, we tend to view gold as an inflation hedge. We tend to view it as a volatility hedge. We tend to view it as it relates to other asset classes. And in fact, in the East, what we're seeing happen is as demand increases there and decreases, relatively speaking, in the West, it becomes an even more non-correlated asset. In other words, it's moving for other reasons and is not moving in lockstep with the stock market. Looking at U.S. equities in particular, at its worst, correlation for 2011 was 86%. In other words, it doesn't matter if you're a brilliant stock picker. Everything was either moving up or down in lockstep. Now, at its worst, gold was correlated to the equity markets about 15% last year, with many years of being even lower in terms of its correlation. And a part of that non-correlation is now being driven by a change in the demand geography, if you will. So it offers something that is moving outside of your financial markets. Yes, for a day, a week, a month, you can see gold move in lockstep with equity markets as perhaps people are moving to liquidity or just everything is moving with one trend. But again, if you look at the chart that we showed on gold in particular, silver as well, what you see is a very divergent trend over the last decade and something that is truly non-correlated over the intermediate and long term, where, again, you have assets which have appreciated 400 to 600%. Contrast that with the S&P 500 and the Dow, which are essentially flat for the decade. Now, the second point, after non-correlation, is dealing with negative real interest rates. What do we mean by that? A positive interest rate, real interest rate, and I emphasize the word real, is what you keep after you've paid taxes and after you've accounted for inflation, positive being above the zero threshold. Negative real rates, if you are in a flat interest rate environment, and that we certainly are given the FOMC's current zero interest rate policy, or if you're in a period in time where your assets are not appreciating that aggressively, say equities over the last 10 years, what you tend to find is you still pay taxes on whatever gains you have, as meager as they may have been, even if it's just dividend income. On top of that, you have to account for inflation. When you put those two factors into the equation, if you have a low single digit, 1, 2, 3%, or even negative real rate of return, then investors tend to favor precious metals. And this has been the case for a long, long time. In fact, if you go back to the Summers-Barsky thesis, Kevin and I have discussed this on the program many times, Larry Summers, and I can never remember Mr. Barsky's first name, but these two gentlemen put together a great study on the math behind why precious metals do well in a period of low to negative real rates of return. And then it's easy to understand when you're forced to take risk in the marketplace, but there's not adequate reward, then oftentimes investors will simply choose to move, quote unquote, to the sidelines and get out of the fray. Again, why take risk if there's no reward for it? And so that low to negative real rate of return environment is critical. And until we reemerge into a strong growth cycle, a business cycle that is supportive to growing company profits, et cetera, and that being a rewarding proposition for shareholders, you'll continue to see people say, well, I guess I should be on the sidelines with at least a few of my dollars for the time being. And of course, that becomes even more true as people are concerned about systemic risk. You know, we don't have to look very far to see today why people are concerned with systemic risk. The last point we'll make is on purchasing power, because this, in terms of the demand side of the precious metals market, is very critical. What we've seen happen over the last 10 years is radical expansion of purchasing power for the gold owner. We're going to redefine terms here a little bit. Everyone likes to look at the current environment that we're in as an inflationary environment, given the activities of the world's central banks expanding that the monetary base is hither and yon. In fact, our next chart shows that the Federal Reserve has, in fact, done that on a radical basis. Starting about 2008, we've absolutely exploded to the numbers we've never seen before, our balance sheet. So we're coming up on $3 trillion for the Federal Reserve balance sheet, annual adjusted monetary balance sheet. We're not alone in that. The ECB has actually expanded their balance sheet even more than ours, at close to $3.5 trillion, and of course the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and a whole host of other central banks are doing the same thing in an attempt to liquefy the system. Now, all that to say, we like to think of this as being an inflationary environment, but let's look at this slightly differently for the time being. Let's define inflation and deflation and then look at gold briefly in a slightly different light. If you define inflation as your money purchasing less and less as time goes on, and deflation as your money purchasing more and more goods and services as time goes on, then the real question is, what is your money? Is your money yen? Is your money euros? Is your money greenbacks, U.S. Treasury bills? Is your money gold and silver? And for many people who have redenominated a part of their savings in precious metals, actually what you found is one of the great deflations. Going back to those two definitions, and I say deflations because your money in gold and silver terms is buying more and more goods and services as time goes on. That's another way of looking at it, because you could say gold and silver are in a bull market. They're growing. The other way of saying it is that we're in the context of one of the great deflations. The problem that most people have is having a faulty reference. They still place more confidence in the currency as a reference than they should. And I'm specifically talking about yen, euros, greenbacks, etc. So when people look at those currencies, they assume that it has some sort of a fixed value, and they can measure a gallon of milk, a gallon of gas, an ounce of gold against this defined and fixed measure, when in fact, since 1971, no currency has been fixed to anything. They've all been floating relative to each other. And that's why this concept of purchasing power is so critical, because when you begin to price assets in something that is a constant, again, not constant in terms of value, but just relatively scarce, hard to come by, in contrast with fiat currency, which can be created infinitely with the stroke of a pen or the stroke of a key on a keyboard, what you see is an increase in purchasing power of real goods.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
We've often looked at the Dow gold ratio, and we will in just a minute. But before we do, one of the charts that I've also included here is this chart of excess reserves of depository institutions. And it's important to look at this because we're going back to the 1960s and certainly before that. We haven't seen banks as concerned about lending to each other or lending into the economy for small business loans, et cetera, as we have in the last several years. And this is not lightening up in the least. You say to yourself that banks make money by putting money into the system. Banks make money by loaning to other people and then collecting interest on that. When in fact we see banks now taking the liquidity that the Fed has provided for them, which is intended to be a stimulant to the economy, they've taken that money, and instead of loaning it out to the tune of $1.6 trillion, they've put it right back on deposit with the Fed. Now, this tells us two things. One, they're petrified of the economy and petrified of the current state of affairs. And two, they're gradually rebuilding their own balance sheets and strengthening themselves in a period of low interest rates. This is what they did in China during the 1990s in their banking crisis. They lowered rates to the point where the saver and the funds which should have been directed to the saver in terms of compensation for their deposits was in fact retained by the bank, and the banks were gradually allowed to rebuild their balance sheet. That is what is happening today. The Federal Reserve System and their zero interest rate policy favors banks and the gradual reconstruction of strength, if you will, within the banking community. Now, the third and final note on that chart of excess reserves and depository institutions is that if you imagine the Hoover Dam and the vast quantities of liquidity or water standing behind the Hoover Dam, that is represented by the excess reserves of depository institutions. As and when those deposits begin to come into the economy, they have not a $1.6 trillion footprint, but on the basis of our fractional reserve banking system, have anywhere from a 3 to 5 to 10 to 12 times footprint in the economy. And again, this deals with the velocity of money, the number of times a dollar goes through our economy and through the banking system. And again, that's multiplied because of the way we do our banking using a fractional reserve banking system. So what we would say is that when we were just discussing deflation and purchasing more and more with your savings denominated in precious metals, what you have here is the makings of superinflation, even hyperinflation, with the excess reserves of depository institutions coming into the economy at an inopportune time. The irony would be this. As and when those deposits come into the economy, they have the first impact of creating the impression that we're returning to normal. The economy is growing again. And then you really feel the weight of all the excess money that's been created. So a little is good, a lot is not better when it comes to inflation. And that is our fear, is that we actually have quite a bit of inflation in terms of greenback-denominated inflation in store. That last point, again, to go back to purchasing power, because this is essentially one of the most powerful charts we're going to look at next, the long-term Dow-Gold ratio. And what's important to see here is that we have been through these trends before. If you go back 100 years, it's in time where paper assets are preferred over tangible assets. Paper assets, specifically stocks and bonds, are preferred over gold. And we saw that in the late 1920s, where we saw great appreciation in equities. And it favored the investor who was in paper assets as opposed to tangibles. Then in the period of the 1930s, after the market had crashed in 1929, after legislation was put in place in the 1930s, after the FDR administration began to put together a whole regime, there was more concern in the 1930s that we were moving towards an outright dictatorship than at any other time in U.S. history. And FDR's folks, the New Deal folks, were paralyzing investors' and businesses' ability to allocate capital. They simply would not do it. So you went into this period of freeze-up, of contraction, of gridlock, if you will. And during that period, tangibles, having possession and control of your assets, privately held, portable, I mean, things that you take for granted under normal circumstances, those issues were prioritized, and you saw a great bull market in precious metals, 1929 through the 30s. And then, of course, 1949, at the end of World War II, actually after World War II, not as a result of World War II, but actually as a result of your new dealers basically taking a back seat and allowing a new administration to come in and sort of retool for growth, with the command economy of World War II no longer being in place and there being, again, greater growth prospects for businesses, circa 1946, 1947, 1948, ultimately the stock market began to advance, 1949 up until about 1966, another great bull market for paper assets. That turned around, if you're looking at the chart, and we went through a bear market between 1966 and 1982. And that was also a great time to be invested in precious metals. Then you go through the greatest of bull markets and paper assets from 1982 to the year 2000. They're on the far right of the chart. Prices and equities have never before seen levels. And gold was absolutely worthless by the time we got to the year 2000. Now, for the astute investor and the person who's looking at history, you might have said, well, at a 43-to-1 ratio, and that is, you take your Dow stocks, your Dow components, and exchange them for gold, and you would have gotten 43 ounces. That was a good time to be coming into the gold market. Again, in terms of purchasing power, you had a lot of purchasing power with your equities. Now we're in that reverse trend where you're seeing an increased purchasing power for the gold holder. We've gone from a 43-to-1 ratio. We're now at a 7-to-1 ratio. I mean, this is what's compelling, because many people will look at this chart and say, oh, we've missed the market. We've completely missed the market. The reality is this. If you take that 43-to-1 number, 43, divided by the current Dow Gold ratio, 7, what you've done is basically increased your purchasing power sixfold. 43 divided by 7, 6. You've increased your purchasing power 6 times, or 600% in equity. The person who owns gold during this period of time has done very well, not in dollar terms, but in purchasing power terms. The fantastic thing is that the way the numbers work, the difference between 43 and 7 is the same difference between 7 and 1. In other words, the classic ratio of 1 to 1 on the Dow Gold ratio, we have the exact same math immediately in front of us. A 6-fold increase in purchasing power in a very short period of time, immediately in front of us. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's worth studying this chart, but understanding that these are now exponential numbers you're dealing with. We're not dealing here with linear math. So, you know, the difference between a 7-to-1 ratio and a 1-to-1 ratio, again, 7 minus 1 being 6, six-fold increase in purchasing power immediately in front of us is exactly equivalent to what it's taken 10 years to rack up. So for anyone considering having missed the precious metals bull market, you have to understand how the math works in terms of purchasing power to see your primary benefit. Your primary benefit is not in dollar terms. It's not in nominal values. Your primary benefit is in the translation of gold ounces, a non-productive asset, ultimately into productive assets, whether that's real estate, whether that's businesses, whether that's the lands, plant, and infrastructure of corporate America, selling at a discount relative to your gold ounces. Just to illustrate this point, again, in terms of purchasing power, we'll look and end here with the median home price, because what you have is a decline in dollar values of 25%. If you look at the median home price, dollar versus gold terms, there in the right-hand corner, you can see the decline in dollar value from $219,000 to $164,000. That's the equivalent of a 25% decline. That same decline in gold terms, again, go back 5 years, would have cost you 461 ounces to buy the average single-family home. This is the median existing family home in the U.S. Now it costs you 99. That's essentially saying that it's a 78% decline in gold terms versus a 25% decline in dollar terms. Another way of looking at that, if you go to the next chart, and this is maybe the positive side of this, is that your increase in purchasing power, having savings denominated in gold, would have cost you 461 ounces to buy one house. Now for the same ounces, you can buy 4.5 houses. The next stop for us is, you know, circa 2014, 2015, when your 461 ounces, instead of buying you one house, and today buying you 4.5, buy you closer to 10 houses. So a tenfold increase in purchasing power of the average single family home. You see the same pattern, and that's what we were just talking about in equities, or in businesses or what have you. So these things, going back to the supply and demand dimensions in the precious metals market, non-correlation is absolutely critical. We've seen a change in geography, and we've also seen a favoring of precious metals during periods of low to negative real rates of return. Low to negative real rates of return are periods of time where people want to just be on the sidelines and don't want to be fully invested in the equities market. So, and then last and not least is the purchasing power. The inspiration for people to own gold because it preserves and during these periods increases purchasing power. That's why we're seeing investors come into the metals market in droves. We'll end with our chart, which is, again, a perspective triangle, something Kevin and I talk about with great frequency. It's what anchors our decisions. It's a simple asset allocation model, which says there's at least three, and these are the three most important in our opinion, ways of defining the mandates or the jobs, the roles that you give your assets. Number one, growth and income. That's your traditional stock, bond, mutual fund, annuity allocations. Number two, your liquidity mandate, which is cash, bank accounts, treasury bills, CDs, money markets, et cetera. At last, and again, not least, certainly not least, is insurance, where we define precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, as more or less an insurance product. Obviously not in the traditional sense of annuities or whole life or things of that nature, but it's something that is an offset, a hedge for those periods of low to negative real rates of return, et cetera, et cetera. So having a balance in your portfolio of these different mandates, even having a third in each of these categories, has the benefit of giving you an ingrained discipline. Precious metals have been growing now for 10 years. As you move through a cycle of growth in one particular mandate versus another, you begin to reallocate, you begin to reapportion from that growth and put it into the other parts of the investment triangle. So precious metals have done very well over the last 10 years. We anticipate that they will continue to over the next 2 to 3 years. And our invitation to all of our clients is to engage with us deeply in conversation about what a reduction strategy looks like. Not an exit strategy from the metals, but a reduction strategy. As and when we get to peak valuation, what does this mean for our investors? It means that we should be looking at maximizing the purchasing power of your quote-unquote gold-denominated savings and reapportion them into other asset classes more appropriate in terms of their growth profile. I've included our performance charts on our wealth management side, and this is, you know, like 12, 13, 14% per year since inception. I'll just say this. We created our wealth management platform to aid our gold and silver investors in an orderly reduction strategy. So to think of this as a future tense event, not necessarily something that you need to do today, but our wealth management team is very adept at managing assets under any circumstances. 2008, 2009, 2010, 11, this year, our average rates of return have been 12.28% up to about 14.07%. And again, this is in a challenged business environment. The purpose of our wealth management is, again, for our precious metals clients to be able to reduce their metals exposure as prices reach their peak and be able to capture some gains and move them to greener pastures, so to say. And we'll look at this last sort of chart. It's a gold chart, but what we've done, this is courtesy of Ian McCavity, fantastic technical analyst, rebasing the current precious metals gold market and comparing it to the last precious metals gold market from 1968 to 1980. What you find is that the move thus far has been beautiful, it's been strong, it's been aggressive, but it's been nothing compared to what we saw in the 1970s and 80s. That third leg higher, that third wave, if you will, in a bull market takes things on the basis of parabolic move to levels that you can't hardly imagine. If we saw the same percentage increase during this bull market as we did 1970 and 1980, we'd have to see gold roughly $5,479 per ounce to match the same percentage increase the last bull market. What I would suggest, going back to the supply and demand dimensions of this market, is that the base of demand is so much broader and so much more global than it was during the 1970s and 80s. That we may not have the imagination, even in our office, for the ultimate price trajectory of gold and or silver. So just keep in mind that current prices are, in our view, not only attractive, but particularly from the standpoint of purchasing power, compelling, immediately in front of us, having anywhere from a 4- to 6-fold increase in purchasing power immediately in front of us. That's, in a nutshell, what we discussed, minus the questions and answers at our conference in the Bahamas. But we talked about gold, we talked about its purchasing power, we talked about its non-correlation, we talked about negative real rates, and we talked about some of the fundamentals of new gold coming into the market, as well as the increase in the demand equation, and why for the next several years, 2 to 3, we're very, very bullish on the metals. If this is something that you need to engage with proactively or strategically with one of our advisors, we have a whole team of folks that have been doing this for over 25 years on average, an exceptionally talented group of men and women who are very committed to what they do and do it with the utmost of professionalism. So if you feel like you need guidance, if you want to review prospective triangle and how your assets currently fit into that, if you want to anticipate an orderly reduction strategy as we come into the third and most aggressive phase in the bull market in precious metals, I encourage you to call our office, 800-525-9556. Speak with one of our advisors and get a strategy in place that supports this orderly reduction in order to maximize purchasing power in the years ahead. So, again, this was the gist of the presentation we gave in the Bahamas. I hope this has been helpful for you. With some visual references, feel free to scroll back through the charts that we've provided for you. And we'll look forward to discussing these things and other issues with you in the days and weeks and months ahead.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. you should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.